we're not the sort of people who sit in offices looking down on and looking at LPA production. You know, we want to create and put our heart and soul into the liquid in the bottle.
We are Miriam,
Martin,
and Manuel. We love podcasts, traveling, and whiskey.
On our trips, we talk to the people to bring their stories to you and to share our love for the water of life.
This is Inside Whiskey, the Barrel Talk. Today, we're in Yorkshire, near the seaside town of Filey, where farming heritage, coastal climate and a bold idea have come together to create a very special English single malt. We are at the Spirit of Yorkshire Distillery, home to Filey Bay Whiskey, and we're joined by co-founder David Thompson. Hi, David.
Hello, how are you doing?
We're good, how are you?
Good.
So now, before we dive into barley, stills and coastal maturation, let's start with a very simple question for starters. There are not too many places in the UK where you are closer to the barley fields, which we can see just outside the window, and the coast. What else makes this place special?
Gosh, what makes it special? Well, it's home, I guess. And home is always special, but I've been brought up here. My friends around here. So you get used to sort of home, don't you? It's it's a place that you always want to come back to. And Filey Bay in particular is gorgeous because it's got lovely rolling hills dropping into the sea, and it's pretty unique. It's a 7 mile beach, which is probably one of the largest beaches as well in the UK. So yeah, it's home, and I think that would sum it up really.
Nice. So David, what is your actual background, and apart from it being home, why did you decide to build the distillery right here?
So my background, really, I started in agriculture. So I worked on a farm as a small boy for 2 or 3 years and decided I wanted to really study farming. So I went to Nottingham University and studied agricultural merchanting, which is effectively how you buy, sell different products that farmers make. And actually, malting barley was one of the biggest subjects I covered. So I learned how to grow a barley crop. I learned how to market it, sell it, and then got really interested in brewing and distilling from there. And I actually came back to this area, and I was lucky enough to actually get this area as my area to open the market to Cargill, which is a company I was dealing with. So my job daily was going on farms, talking to farmers, helping them grow their crops, and then buying malting barley at the end of it.
All right.
So really, it wasn't just coming back to home. It was coming back to probably one of the best malting barley growing regions in the UK.
All right. So that makes perfect sense then, because barley is one of the critical ingredients for your whiskey.
It is.
Now, you found that the distillery together with your friend Tom Meller. How did you two get to know each other?
Well, through me going onto his farm and persuading him to give me his barley to sell. So that's where it really started. But at the same time, he was a very good rugby player, and he knew that I had played a lot of good rugby as well, and he wanted me to play for his team.
All right.
So he actually said to me, okay, I'm going to let you buy my barley if... and only if you play for my rugby team. So the friendship was around business, but also around rugby. And since then, the families have grown up together, and we've sort of always been friends.
All right. I mean, that's a great background story, actually. Now, what was that moment, or when was that moment? How was that moment when you finally actually realized we want to build a distillery? How did that come about?
Yeah, I guess it's rewinding to the 80s when farming was not particularly profitable. And obviously it's very seasonal as well. So Tom was looking for something that could add value to what he grew. And he also had water on the farm as well that was grown. The well was actually on the farm, so they've never had mains water on the farm. So you've got two of the main ingredients to make beer and whiskey. So nearly 22, 3 years ago, he decided to make beer. Mm-hmm. And it was at a time when not really many people made, there wasn't any many micro breweries around. Right, yeah. So everybody thought it was crazy, but but he was using the raw materials he had, and he's now got a very successful brewery called Walltop Brewery, which is run by his daughter now. So that was really the first step, because as we all know, wash is fundamentally a beer without hops and a few other things that are slightly different. So we came from that background of farming and brewing, and the logical step was to make whiskey, as we already had that infrastructure and knowledge of how to make a really good wash.
Now, farming and brewing, you already mentioned it. This is the two backgrounds that you have. It's really super essential when you build a distillery, but there's so much more in building a distillery, so like all the business part of it and everything. Mm. So who brings what to the table in these regards?
Okay, yeah. Tom's an ideas guy. He's really, really good at looking outside the box. He's also very good with his hands. He's very down to earth, I guess. I come from the other side. I am very good with my hands as well, but I love flavours. I love cooking. I love all those sorts of things. And I sort of love whiskey. I love creating things. I also had a couple of marketing businesses as well. So I've got the marketing side attached to me as well. So yeah, it was joining two skill sets actually that complemented each other, and together we actually helped build the distillery. And in the first sort of year, we did all the distilling just Tom and myself, and we learned that from the great Dr. Jim Swan.
We will talk about Jim Swan in a few minutes, but before that, building a distillery is not really a cheap endeavor. It's actually quite expensive. So how did you manage to finance it? Did you sell gin, casks? I don't know. What did you do to finance it?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yes, I mean, it's always a battle. And I guess we're quite unique in the fact that we still own 99% of the business between the families. There's lots of ways of financing, but effectively we went down the road of doing it ourselves. And that's through traditional bank lending. However, a lot of other distilleries go down the crowdfunding and raising money that way. We've never done that. We've kept complete control over the business. Yes, we have sold a few casks, which has helped cash flow at times, but it really isn't easy, because every time you make something, you put it back into the business. You're buying casks all the time. So, you know, after sort of nearly 10 years of being in business, we've got probably a different business model in terms of finance than most businesses.
Yeah. All right. It's also very interesting, but it's great to have full control, I suppose. Mm. Now, looking back at those early days, founding the distillery, the ideas, whatever. Building it yourself. Yeah. Is there a particular moment that kind of stuck with you that you think, from today's perspective, that is kind of a very special moment?
It's like most things. It's the first time you turn the stills on. You know, we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know which levers to pull and what really to do. What we did know is how to make a really good wash because of the beer background. So we knew we had the starting place. It was good. However, distillation was something we had to learn. And we didn't have that expertise. But the key here is we wanted to learn it. As individuals, we wanted to know how to make the best spirit we possibly could. So when we eventually did employ other people, we could pass on our learnings, and part of us went through that process. So that was super important. We're not the sort of people who sit in offices looking down on and looking at LPA production. You know, we want to create and put our heart and soul into the liquid in the bottle. So that's why we did that.
Well, actually, that already sounds like very good whiskey in the end. But if you could look back right now and like send a message to David roughly 10 years ago, which message would that be?
Just in believing in the future, believe in yourself. I mean, there's ups and downs all the way. And, you know, it's like any business. There's good times, there's bad times, there's tough times. And, you know, we're in a tough time at the moment. I mean, the market is not brilliant. But We have created a business that's quite lean. It's one of those things you've got to flex very quickly. Which we've been able to do because we're in control.
Yes,
if we had a board of 30 people, that might be more challenging. but we just sit around the table, make a decision, and we go with it.
I think it's important to trust yourselves there. It's Well, whiskey is going to be an up and down always. Yeah. Every business is.
Yeah, and it's a very, very long-term business. So
yeah, it's a generational business. Yes, absolutely. And it's important to remember that.
Yep.
Yeah. So let's talk about your approach a little bit. You call your approach field to bottle. From the way we experienced you and talking about growing the barley, having the beer background and or the agricultural background, we feel like this is not just a slogan that you chose for your distillery, but it's more like what you really do. It's a philosophy. So how would you describe the field to bottle approach to us?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything starts with on basic terms, the soil we walk on, the soil we grow things in. And I think intensive farming has done a job. It's produced high quality grains and a lot of it to feed people fundamentally. Just after the war, I think we overworked the soil. We were using a lot of chemicals. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We were ploughing the soil and moving it around a lot. And if you do that, you effectively are breaking up the structure of the soil. So it's super important for us not just to call it field to bottle, but actually to be farming in an environmentally regenerative way.
Mm-hmm.
So we adopted farming techniques that are fundamentally looking after the soil for the future generations, which means no ploughing, no mm-hmm. cultivations, minimal cultivations if we have to.
And you will need to do that because you just said it's a generational business, so you will also need the fields in future generations.
Absolutely. And we're not just doing this because it's a great slogan to put on your bottle. We're not greenwashing. We're doing it because it's right for the future of the land, the soil, and our industry. You know, at the end of the day, if we don't have good barley, we don't have beer or whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that we're in control of the crop all the way through the process. Mm-hmm. We're also growing other things within the field, which complement the barley. So clovers and different varieties of brassicas. So this helps the structure of the soil, and it also helps water retention, moisture mm-hmm. retention, and sequester carbon. So we're actually right, yes. locking carbon back into the soil by the way we're farming, mm-hmm. which again, isn't just a slogan. It's actually happening.
Mm-hmm. So we wanted to ask that later on, but it fits perfectly right now. And how far would you say terroir actually plays a role in the taste of the whiskey?
Would you call it terroir?
Yes.
Okay. Controversial.
yeah, absolutely.
Okay, as farmers and four generations of farming have been in on the land growing barley for all of that time, we believe that barley, because it's only in the soil for a maximum of 4 months, mm-hmm. Has very little time to pick up mm-hmm. flavour from its terroir. What is important for barley is it's grown on the right land to produce the best quality barley. So I don't actually believe that terroir or the land type actually adds flavour to mm-hmm. our barley.
Yeah.
I think it's a choice-driven thing. So it's the way you distill, it's the way you mature, it's mm-hmm. the way you ferment, that adds flavour.
Yes. So some people are really talking a lot about terroir, and others say, well, it's not really that much of an issue. But yeah, as you said, it's very much about the way you produce your product that plays a very, very important role in that respect.
Yeah, it's the way you process those mm-hmm. materials that adds flavor. And the barley is just a carrier of sugar for me.
Yeah.
Yes, you can get nuance, but by the time you've distilled it, fermented it and matured it, you know, if you can pick up a nuance of terroir, mm-hmm. Good luck to you.
Now, you've mentioned before that you basically had consultancy with Jim Swan. So we have heard what you bring to the table, what Tom brings to the table. But what did he bring to the table, and how far did he influence what you're doing here?
I mean, Jim Swan is a legend.
He is a legend.
Within the industry. You know, everything goes before Jim, really. And we needed somebody of his caliber to help us from word go. So mm-hmm. before we even decided to actually go ahead with the project, we talked to Jim.
Oh, right.
And he really wanted to get to know us. He was a sort of guy who actually selected the people he wanted to work with. and if you weren't serious about it and you weren't serious about making a tasty, high quality whiskey, then he wasn't interested.
He wasn't interested. Yes.
If it's just a money game and trying to get rich quick, he wasn't interested. And so within 10, 15 minutes of chatting with him and him with us, we both got on very well. And he was massively influential on the building of the stills, the way that we distill and the maturation policy. His DNA lives on in Filey Bay.
That's great to hear, and that's a cool thought, to be honest. Now, what would you say is the most important thing he left behind for you?
I think in the back of my mind, you've got to follow certain protocols and principles, but also be flexible enough to create something unique. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't sort of that rigid that the rule book was this and you had to produce whiskey to that rule book. He wanted to build the character of the people, of the place, into the spirit as well.
All right.
So one of the examples of that is we challenged him and said, look, you know, we're not in Scotland. We want to do something slightly different. We've got two four-size pot stills. Can we look at adding a bit more copper contact into there? Mm-hmm. And we came up with a four-plate rectifying column idea, which, as a purist in Scotland, you would have thought Jim would have said, that's crazy, you can't do that. But he actually embraced it. You know, he said, I've never done this before. I see that as a challenge, and I think that's going to really be a good challenge. So he was quite happy to help us design, build and install the four-plate rectifying column, which is part of the reason why Filey Bay is light, fruity and delicate. Mm. Is it comes from that extra copper contact.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk a little bit more in depth about that in just a couple of minutes. Yeah.
But before that, you just said we're not in Scotland, which is true. We're in England. So you English whiskey or English single malt is a bit of a younger movement compared to the Scotch whiskey industry. So how do you feel when you realize that Filey Bay or the Spirit of Yorkshire Distillery is actually turning 10 next year?
Well, it's time flies. Time flies. Looking back, you would have never thought we would have got 10 years so quickly. And that's super exciting for me because, as we all know, whiskey has certain periods of time when 10 years is a key moment. Mm-hmm. Not just because it's a number, but it's because the quality of the liquid and the maturation is getting to its sort of peak or one of its peaks. So it's super exciting. But looking back, you know, you'd think, crikey, where's that time gone?
Yeah, that's always the thing, right? Because 10 years, it's like, my gosh, 10 years ago, I was 25.
Sounds like a lot, but then actually, yeah.
Yeah.
But now, Yorkshire was not really before that. It was not really known for whiskey, but now we feel like it's on the map because you have Filey Bay here. It's been here for almost a decade now. And what role do you hope will Spirit of Yorkshire or the distillery play in the whiskey future of Yorkshire or England going forward?
I think it's important to understand that it doesn't really matter where you are in the world, never mind about the country. If you want to make something like single malt whiskey and you've got the principles and everything set up in the correct way, you can make a great product. Bearing in mind that Yorkshire is one of the main areas for growing high quality malting barley, it seemed crazy to us back then that we never actually made whiskey before. So to be the first is absolutely fantastic. But for the future, I think it puts Filey Bay and Yorkshire on the whiskey map around the world. And that is a legacy that is always going to be there.
And now when you're talking about around the world, you're in very, very different markets. When we chatted before, we were talking about China, we were talking about India and these things. So what is it that you want people to feel when they open a bottle of Filey Bay whiskey in Yorkshire, in Mumbai, in New York, in San Francisco, wherever it is?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Yorkshire is quite an interesting place. I mean, if you ask people outside of the country, what do they know about England? I mean, one of the first things they'll say is London.
Yeah.
and quite often, actually, the second place they'll say is Yorkshire because it's the biggest county in England.
Mm-hmm.
It's got York, a very, very old city. So I think people actually relate to the place. So when they open that bottle, they can relate to, you know, an actual physical place. We always talk about a sense of place in whiskey production.
Yes, right.
Now. And I feel that when you open that Filey Bay, every bottle regardless of the cask maturation, its age, you get that essence of Filey Bay.
Mm.
So, and any distillery really is trying to make their own style. And it's really important that that style, as I say, regardless of maturation policy or cask type, is always going to be there.
Yeah, all right. So it transports them right to the place, and you hope that they actually feel the love that you put into this this kind of project as well.
Yeah.
Lovely. Now, you already talked about the setup that you've got with those, with the rectifying still and the two pot stills, which is quite unique. So in how far do you use them, and in how far does that kind of change the process?
Yeah, we made a decision early on to run the stills without the column for 6 months of the year. And we tend to do that actually in the summer. Mm-hmm. And in the winter, we then turn the column on. So we've got 6 months production, which is pot by itself, mm-hmm. Double pot. So you've got the more oily base whiskey or new make. And then during the summer, we run the column as well. So we're getting a lighter, fruitier type of new make. Now, they're cast separately. That does is gives us another choice in the warehouse of putting together not just different cask types, but also different distillation types.
All right, so I understood that correctly. You're producing two different types of new mix. And would you also, when you release a whiskey, then say the type of new make that has been produced for it?
It depends on the bottling. But if that we feel has got a big influence on that particular bottling, then we will say it's 40% pot.
All right,
6% column. So, I think that's quite a nice little nuance which people can get into.
And it's also a very, very nice comparison if you have them side by side, maybe.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's really interesting, the approach to have two new makes. But in production, let's maybe jump a few steps back. We already talked about the barley and the water well being on the farm, which is 3 miles down the road, I guess. So just next door, basically. And so what type of barley do you use? What type of yeast? And does the water still come from that well on the farm there?
Yeah, lots of questions.
Sorry.
That's okay. Okay. When I was back in the 80s, a lot of the varieties you grew were winter sown, so put in the ground in winter, and they would go through the sort of winter period and then start to grow in the spring, and you'd harvest them in summer.
Mm-hmm.
However, now a lot of the varieties we grow are spring sown,
mm-hmm.
And that's because the varieties have developed and there's more varieties available that malting companies want to buy. So what we did as a business to cover ourselves is still continue with some winter sown varieties, which the one we're using at the moment is called Vessel. And the majority, though, is now spring sown, which is predominantly Concerto.
Mm-hmm.
So that, as a farmer, protecting your own business gives you stability. So, for example, if the spring barley doesn't particularly do well, the winter is more likely to do well.
Yeah.
So it's covering your bases. That's a practical thing, really, and safeguarding the supply chain. The water, is basically a well that's dug into a very deep chalk, which we are blessed with having on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very small amount of soil on top of the chalk. So when you actually look at the fields, you can see the white stones, which are chalk.
Mm-hmm.
What that acts is a filter bed. So when it rains, the water goes through the chalk and filters, and it's going very, very deep. So when we drill a hole into the ground, it fills up from effectively the chalk. So some of the water we're using is potentially hundreds of years old.
Oh, wow.
very stable, very pure, very consistent, which is the main thing for whiskey production or beer production, is it's consistently the same. So the water is a vital part of what we do. And you're absolutely right. We tanker that down to the distillery when we're cutting back our new make spirit and when we're doing other things with the spirit to water it back. So that water is absolutely vital to the process.
Mm-hmm. And how about the fermentation times, and what are you aiming for?
I mean, the fermentation times, we really stuck to what Jim said. I think people mess around a lot with fermentation. They mess around a lot with yeast, which is great, and it's their particular style. What we see is the wash is like the canvas. And the canvas should be the same.
Mm-hmm.
We paint the colours of the picture with the distillation process, the maturation process. So we feel as long as the starting place is the same, we can control things and add flavour further down the track. Totally understand why people play with yeast, but they're quite uncontrollable.
Yeah.
So if you want to produce a particular distillery style, I think it's very tough if you're changing fermentation times, yeast types, etc.
All right.
So that's our philosophy and we stuck to it.
All right. Perfectly understandable. And we've already talked about distillation as well. What is your annual output then?
So our annual output is between 80 and 100,000 litres of pure alcohol.
Okay.
We can do
quite
more.
Quite small.
Yeah, quite small. And we can do more. But because we finance ourselves in the way we finance ourselves, we haven't got a bottomless pit of money where we can just keep buying new casks and keep pushing the boundaries of production.
Yeah.
Which actually is quite nice because we're in control of it. You know, we're not trying to force LPA. We're not trying to make as much liquid as we possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And we can take our time about it. So having a few monetary restraints actually, I suppose, adds to the nuance of your whiskey, you know.
Yeah, right.
So that's basically where we're at the moment.
All right, so you just mentioned the cask, so let's talk about maturation. And how far do you think the Yorkshire climate contributes to maturation here?
What's the Yorkshire climate like, actually?
Because
because we just came down from Scotland. Scotland had horrible weather. We came to Yorkshire and it's beautiful and nice and warm here.
Could be a coincidence, but actually it's very nice, yeah.
I mean, typically we're an island, we're a big island, so we're going to get the influence of the ocean and the sea on every side of the island. And obviously, Scotland and a lot of production is over on the west coast of Scotland, where you're getting the massive influence of the Atlantic. So you're going to get more moisture. It's going to be colder up there as well. It's a bit further north. We're very much in an area on the east coast of Yorkshire, which is a lot drier. You'll probably see that. We don't get as much rainfall. But we do get sort of the influence of the North Sea, which in winter is quite cold. And we get a lot of fog and mists. And obviously that gets in the warehouse. So I think we do get that lovely cold sort of influence of the mist coming rolling in off the North Sea in the winter. In the summer, really, you don't know what you're going to get. Every season's different. But when you're a maritime climate, every day could be different. You know, we can look out the window in the morning and it's sunny, and by the afternoon it's foggy.
Mm.
Oh well, that right now it's good. So
yeah,
I stick window, to yeah. my belief that Yorkshire has beautiful weather and climate all the time.
Yeah, you believe that one.
So warehousing, you just mentioned it all goes into the warehouses. So do you store everything on site, and how many casks do you have here?
Yeah, well, everything's up at the farm. So we're quite unusual in the fact that the farm is as you mentioned earlier, 3 miles away from the distillery. So that's where all our brewing equipment is, and the wash is brought down to the distillery to be distilled. So we effectively have two sites, but under the control of one business and the same people. Sorry, I've forgotten the main question. What was the question?
If you store all the casks.
Oh, the casks, yeah, of course, yeah.
How many you
yeah.
have?
So the warehouse is on the farm. So all the casks are there, and we're just short of 5,000 casks now, of different types.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, unusually, we are in control of every single element. That's the main thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have basically just said that you're producing the wash in a different place than where you actually distill it.
Mm-hmm.
So... and you mentioned before that might cause some problems with the SWA about the, we're calling it a single malt. What do you say about that?
It's a difficult one, but basically, I don't believe that the SWA has control over the word single to start with. But what does single mean? And if we're in control of all of those elements, in fact, growing the barley as well, which... certainly a lot of Scottish distilleries cannot claim to do, and maturing on site and bottling on site, I think we're in control of more elements of the production process than actually a lot of Scottish distilleries or any distillery. So single control, single-minded, single people. You know, it's what does it actually mean? And just because you're brewing and distilling on one site doesn't mean that it's underpinning the quality.
Yeah, and what is a site? I mean, that is also a
exactly how big is a site?
Legitimate question. Yeah, yeah.
There's basically just one road, and then the farm is just there, so we can see it from here, technically.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're getting hung up on a word. Mm. Yes, it means the perception is it means quality. Well, there's a lot of things in a single site that can lose quality.
Yeah. Mm. That's true. And also, this is England and not Scotland. So,
well, there you go. And that's the fundamental difference.
We were talking about the casks beforehand. So I wanted to ask, what cask types do you predominantly use? And do you have any very experimental ones?
Again, we sat down with Jim and talked about cask maturation. And we wanted a light, fruity base product. So the majority of our casks went into first fill bourbon casks, mm-hmm. Which we sourced direct. And I would say in the region of 75% mm-hmm. of first fill bourbon.
Okay.
And then what we do is we have a range of finishing whiskies. So we will take the whiskey out of the bourbon and put them into different cask types. So we've got a Muscatel finish, which is quite an unusual cask, which mm-hmm. is part of our core range. We have Jim Swan's classic STR, shaved, toasted, recharred red mm-hmm. wine cask. These are building up our core range from what we call finishing. Mm-hmm. However, the rest of them are full term, could be Oloroso, could be Pedro Jimenez. We've got Madeira, which is quite mm-hmm. an unusual one as well. And we launched a bottle 6 to 12 months ago now, which is an orange wine barrique. Which was quite unusual. So experimental, but very exciting. And in fact, it sold out unbelievably quickly because it was different, very delicious. Orange and whiskey have always gone well together, but this lovely tangy sort of bitter orange was fantastic.
All right, so many, many different releases, different styles than you're kind of releasing as well. But what connects all those different whiskies that you're releasing?
What connects them is the spirit that goes in.
Yeah.
You know, the starting place, as I say, the canvas of what you produce is the same. That connects it. It connects it in the way it's sort of mouthfeel and the texture of the liquid.
So you can really taste it in all of them.
Yeah. And I think, you know, any distillery who hides their DNA is not going to produce something that's there for the future. And I think you've got to be true to what you want to create. And we always said light, fruity, mm-hmm. You know, distiller, and that's carried through in Filey Bay today.
So is that also the way you would describe your flavor profile, or is there more to it?
I think there is more to it, but it's nuance. It's not sort of massive swings of now we're making a really heavy, dark, sherried, thick whiskey.
You know? Yeah, right.
So the light, fruity whiskey, which is approachable to everybody, mm-hmm. because, you know, at the end of the day, and we'll probably talk about marketing going forward, but at the end of the day, distilleries cannot rely on just selling aged, very old whiskies, dark whiskies.
Right.
They have to really look at new audiences and be more approachable. So we hope that Filey Bay allows people to get into whiskey at that level of light, fruity and approachable.
Yeah, and you also want to showcase the whiskey and not only the cask.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely
it. The whiskey is what you're making, it's not the cask.
It is.
if you were now to compare one of your very early releases with what you've got right now, has it changed a lot?
I mean, naturally, as the wood does its thing and you know, you're getting a softer spirit, you're getting a softer and more flavoursome spirit. So maturation is something that you cannot speed up. A lot of people have tried in the past, and I think, you know, the beauty of whiskey is it goes through a natural process. Mm-hmm. And if you try and influence that maturation, I think you're going to end up with something that's a little bit odd.
That's right. But do you kind of already have an idea of what you expect your whiskey to taste in, then, let's say, when it's 20, another 10 years?
Gosh, crystal ball stuff.
Yeah,
Not really. And I think that is the beauty of whiskey, is you don't really know what you're going to end up with. But the principle is, if you make a great spirit and you've got great barley and you've got great process, then you stand a fighting chance of making something really delicious in the future.
And it's part of the fun, like this unknown kind of thing.
Yeah, and I got an example of that. You know, two Madeira casks filled on the same day, same spirit, put in the warehouse next to each other, completely different taste. You know, how has that happened? You know, where did that come from? But that is the beauty of it.
Yes, well, absolutely.
That's the interesting thing, and it also makes consistency difficult sometimes. But are you planning a consistent core range, and how do you get there? How do you get to consistency when neighboring casks even might be completely different?
Well, that's very much to do with, for example, if you take Flagship, that is made up of several casks, many casks. And it's
all bourbon, right?
And it's all bourbon. Yep. Yeah. So we use like a loosely termed Solera type system. So you've got a big 10,000 litre tank. You fill it to the top with 30 casks. You then empty half of it. That goes in one of your bottlings and then you top it up. So what you're getting is consistency throughout the Flagship. Yes, you've got slight nuances, but generally speaking, you will have created something quite consistent.
Okay.
So that's the way you the bigger the batch, the more consistent, basically.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. I'm not doing this, so I'm always thinking like,
Yeah, it always sounds so difficult to make, like with all those different casks, and we were talking about single casks as well, that altogether you finish with a product that kind of remains the same. Sounds very difficult, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not easy, but keeping true to your DNA is the most important part of having a distillery.
Now, how important are single cask bottlings in your portfolio, and how do you select which single cask will be a single cask?
Well, again, you know, going back to the fact that every cask is doing something different at different times, I've got this wonderful guy that's been working for us right from the start called Joe Clark. He's been in the industry for many, many years, and he's got the...
Is that the master of liquid?
He's a master of liquid. Did I actually say that? Don't tell him that.
Yeah. No,
yeah. You might hear it, yeah.
Well, you know, he is, and he's sort of so passionate about the warehouse and the casks, and, you know, he's almost got individual names for them. You know, he knows what's going on. And you need somebody like that, because otherwise a cask will go past you and you'll miss it. So the key to it is being in the warehouse as much as possible, tasting as much as possible, nosing as much as possible. And you end up getting to understand what's happening to an individual cask. Mm-hmm. So the selection process then comes down to Joe saying, okay, I've got down to five. He'll come to me and we'll sit down and we'll taste those five. We'll nose those five independently of each other, although we're sitting in the same room, don't talk to each other. And then we compare notes. And 99% of the time, we're pretty much of the same belief which one will go into a bottle.
Do you know what you're tasting then, or is it kind of a blind tasting?
No, it's blind.
He just gives you five.
Yeah, he just gives us blind to start with. And that's cool. The first thing you write on your piece of paper is what cask you think it's from.
Oh, very nice. I love those blind thingies. Now, will you ever do peated expressions?
Well, this is an interesting one. So we've talked, and we'll probably talk a little bit about farming and looking after the soil. And carbon capture, and you're thinking, where the hell is he going? We're talking about peated whiskey. Well, basically, if you're digging peat out of the ground, you're digging carbon out of the ground.
True.
You're doing something that is contrary to what we're doing on the farm. So in principle, no. So the workaround we've got, because we do have peated expressions, but they are working with ex Isla casks.
Ah, yeah, right.
So we're using something that perhaps is a byproduct of the Isla industry to add a peated flavour to our spirit. And the peated finish we've got has won so many awards. It's unbelievable. And it gives you that entry peat. It's very delicate. And it's one of those that if people aren't quite into peat, it's a really good starting place.
All right. Lovely. Now, let's kind of go away from the whiskey a little bit and talk about community and your future vision. Now, you do have a proper visitor center here. You do have a shop. You do have a cafe. Has the idea always been to welcome the public in, basically?
I think it starts before the public. It starts with the people who employ. And, you know, it's a place, but it's also the people. And everybody that works for us is local. They're from the area. And I think it's so important when you start a business that you put back into the business, into the community by employing the people around you. And of course, they have the passion. You know, they have the passion of the area. They have the passion. They've been brought up here. They live here. So I think it's super important that the legacy isn't just the whiskey, but it's the place and the people that are working for us.
Mm-hmm. How has the, when you were building the distillery, communities are kind of, they can be very happy about it. They can be not too happy about it in the beginning. Now, you're saying like you're employing the locals, you're building something that is also for the locals. Mm. How has the local Yorkshire community responded?
Very positively, because I've never had something like this. So we're looked at as quite unique, I suppose. In Scotland, there's another distillery being built, and I think it hasn't got the same sort of feel of something brand new. Mm-hmm. So I think the Yorkshire people are, what we call it, reserved. They don't like change. But actually, if the change is for good, then, they're on board with it. And I think we've been supported. We're fiercely proud people of the Yorkshire people. So if they can get behind something, they will. And there's 5.5 million people in Yorkshire, which is more than all of Scotland, would you believe?
I was about to say, that's quite a few.
So they've got behind us, they've supported us, and I think that's a testament to the place we live in.
And there will also be, you mentioned it before, not on the podcast, but to us, you mentioned it before, in July you will have an open weekend. Mm. What is happening there?
Okay, so it's actually, should be on the 1st of August, but that
hardly
ever falls on a weekend. it does, but not this time. So it's the last weekend in August. And effectively, it's like our version of an Islay festival. So we have music, we have people coming and travelling from abroad to come to it, which is super exciting. Lots of tastings, lots of sort of talks. We've got a cooper making barrels. We've actually got a Yorkshire cooper who looks after some of our barrels for us. I can talk about something exciting there in a minute as well. It's just a lovely day out, and you don't have to travel far if you're from Yorkshire.
That's right.
For us, it's a bit of a way, but now that we know that the weather in Yorkshire is always beautiful.
Of course it is.
And obviously, we don't want you to stop here. What's the exciting thing you wanted to talk about?
So we sort of are a business that wants to grow the barley. We want to be in control of everything. And the one thing we're not in control of is the casks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So a couple of 3 years ago now, we actually got a hold of some Yorkshire oak. And our cooper friend has made Yorkshire oak casks.
Oh, wow.
And we've got spirit sitting there nicely maturing away in virgin Yorkshire oak. So we've completed the circle. And again, not many people can say that.
Super local. Wow.
What does it taste like?
I have no idea.
You have no idea?
No, it's early days and you can't really judge, but it's definitely gone off very quickly, like virgin oak wood.
Yeah.
So it's maturing quite a pace. We might have to slow it down.
So we'll keep our eyes open then.
Well, Yorkshire wood sounds very interesting.
Yeah. So it's 100% Yorkshire.
Great. Now, talking about those special events like the opening weekend, but altogether, when visitors come here, what can they expect? What kinds of tours, tastings, whatever do you do?
Yeah, well, there's been a dual site. It's sometimes a little challenging because people obviously want to see the mash and where the actual wash is made. So you can do a joint tour. You can go up to the brewery, do a joint tour. It's right in the middle of the farm as well, so you can see where the barley is grown. You can come down here and do a full tour of the distillery. Mm-hmm. We've got a coffee shop and other things going on as well. And we actually do have a distilling day. You can come and do a whole day of distilling with us as well.
Oh, cool. Oh.
So there's all sorts of really exciting things, depending on what you want from it, really. Lots of in-depth tastings as well. So, yeah, it's quite exciting.
So we need to come back for a distilling day, Martin.
Well, I've definitely never done that before.
We neither. So. And now, David, we're slowly coming to the end of our podcast. Just a few more questions. So what are the future plans for the brand and the distillery?
When you set out, your goal is always to, ours was to make a world-class whisky that's recognised everywhere. And, that's our goal. That's our challenge. And there's bumps and humps along the way. You know, we've got lots of going on in the world at the moment, but that is still our future. We want to make something that is recognized throughout the world.
So success would be if in 10 years everyone knows Filey Bay whiskey as a world-class whiskey.
Yeah, but we've also got to be realistic. And I don't think everybody will, but I think it's important that we spread it around the world more people are drinking Yorkshire whiskey, the better for me. But also a legacy. So, you know, it's here for the future. We haven't built this like a lot of distilleries for a quick buck. You know, we're not trying to be in and out and flip the business. We're here for generations to come, hopefully.
Yeah. You're usually not building a distillery for you yourself. I mean, you're doing it for you yourself now, but you're also hoping for future generations that they will step in and bring this forward.
And I said to you earlier, whiskey is a generational business. It's not one thing you can flip in and out. And I think... It's a difficult one as well because people looking inward, it's not like a standard business. I mean, who has the amount of stock in a business? Say, for example, a clothing company, and you have the amount of stock that we've got, you'd think that's crazy. Mm-hmm. But it's the backbone of a whiskey business. And of course, it appreciates, and most stock depreciates in value. Yeah. So it's an upside down sort of business. But once you get your head around it, then, you can start to understand it.
And now, when you... Well, we're in Yorkshire. This is 110 miles, around 180 kilometers away from Scotland, so not too far, but there are still purists around to say, like, the only whiskey we're ever going to drink is Scotch. How do you try to convince them that actually English whiskey can be pretty bloody good?
Well, the first thing I do is don't tell them it's English. So, the key is put the glass in somebody's hand. When they ask where it's from, you throw it back at them and say, you tell me.
Yeah, right.
And 9 times out of 10, they will get it completely wrong. And they'll say it's Scotch, they'll say it's Lowland, they'll say this Speyside, whatever. And then they're convinced because actually they're convinced the taste, the thing they've got in the mouth is actually really tasty and they're enjoying it. So I think we shouldn't get hung up on where things are made per se, because doesn't mean it's higher quality. It just means it's different. Mm-hmm. And I think, that's been the biggest challenge is getting people to actually accept the fact that you don't need to be in Scotland to make great whiskey.
So why should a border stop you from making great whiskey?
It's about the people or place. It's not about where you are.
100%. And now about that great whiskey. What is the favorite whiskey that you have released so far?
Gosh, what? When people ask me this, I think the standard answer for me really is it depends who I'm with, the time and place.
Yeah, right.
And I think it there isn't just one, but I think it's like a song or music. You remember the song and the people you're with at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what whiskey's all about. So I'm sorry to disappoint. There isn't one.
No, that's all right.
But if I had to say one, it's the Orange Wine Barrique.
Okay. Well, you mentioned
one
at last. There isn't one, but there is one.
There might be one.
No, we said that so many times. It's so often about the stories, about the company, about what you associate with the dram at the very moment. And that's,
like, we had a lovely dram last night, and I'll remember that night. It wasn't even one of ours.
Well, still a good one, though. Now, we're basically coming towards the end of the podcast, and we always finish with a couple of quick questions. Now, here's the first one for you, and we know that you're into tennis. So if you had to compare your whiskey to a tennis player, who would it be and why?
Oh, Roger Federer. Absolutely. Delicate, fantastic, light feet, elegance, majestic, where can you go wrong? And actually, Yorkshire Day, the 1st of August, is actually Swiss Day as well.
All right, there
so
you
we've
go.
So we've got a connection, and my wife's half Swiss.
All right, okay. So then that definitely...
Full circle again.
Yeah.
that was an easy question.
That was spot on, yeah. I'm sorry for the easy question.
Let's see, the second one might be easy as well. So when you're traveling a lot for whiskey festivals and fairs, and you're abroad with Filey Bay quite a lot. Mm. So what's the number one question you're always being asked?
Gosh, what's the number one question have I asked?
Not as easy as Roger Federer.
God, no, that's a difficult one. Okay, what's the number one question? Okay, I guess it's the one you asked me, is what my favourite whiskey? which I think we've covered. It's probably the number one question. And the second one is why? Why are you actually making whiskey in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And I think the why word is you've got to have the answer to the why word.
Well, that should be
there. And you know, I think that is probably the most common question is, why did you actually set up a distillery in Yorkshire?
All right, last question now. If your whiskey this time was a music genre, which one would it be and why?
Oh, wow. Okay. That's an interesting one. I think probably it's a mixture of classical rock.
All right.
Yeah, because it's got the sort of soft side of the classical sort of genre, but also sometimes one of our whiskies really hits you and you think, okay, all right, that's gone to the next level.
Classic rock.
If there is a classic rock genre, then I think
I think there is.
Oh, yeah. Classic
so we're
rock
talking
counts.
About Roger Federer and classic rock.
Yeah.
It's a good combination, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Not bad. So that's the end of our podcast. Thank you so much, David, for joining us and for giving us all the insights about Spirit of Yorkshire and Filey Bay whiskey. And if you would like to get to know more about Filey Bay and Spirit of Yorkshire, visit their website on spiritofyorkshire.com and follow them on social media at Spirit of Yorkshire. We are Martin and Miriam, and this was Inside Whiskey, the Barrel Talk with David Thompson from the Spirit of Yorkshire Distillery, home of Filey Bay Whiskey. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much. That was great.
Thank you for joining us on the Barrel Talk today. If you enjoyed this episode, tune in again next time for some more tales about the water of life. And in the meantime, follow us on Instagram at @inside_whiskey, on Facebook at Inside Whiskey The Barrel Talk, or visit our website on insidewhiskey.de. This was Inside Whiskey, The Barrel Talk. Thank you.